It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
It's back down to meat locker temperature in here again. It was nice and warm in here last week.
I know.
Oh, I actually had turned it up a little bit. It's warmer than what it was, so it was really cold. Yeah, well, I know you're lost all sensation in your limbs. all we need is your mouth to keep working for another 30 minutes, Josh. And you never seem to have a problem with that.
No, not that.
Even when the brain's frozen.
Yes.
Especially when the brain's frozen.
Resist that.
Yeah. Well, it's true. It's totally true.
Well, we have big election coming up.
Yeah, we do, and we have normally in the past we've spread these out over 2 weeks, but we decided since it's a relatively short and confusing ballot this week that we would cram it all into 1 week. So
make it a short and confusing show.
Exactly. Each primary, and also we do this before the general election too, Eat the State puts out its election endorsements and run through and tell you what we think about some of these different races. Of course, as just about everybody knows at this point, it's a different type of ballot this time. We are stuck with the need to declare which party you are, and you will get a ballot for that party. You can only vote for one. You can only they're not separate ballots actually. They're all in one ballot, but you can only vote for one of the lists of candidates. It'll be Democratic or Republican or Libertarian. If you're Libertarian, you get to vote for governor, and that's it. And then in the general election, you can vote for anyone you want. So this is, incidentally, the only election that we will have using this system, because almost certainly there will be either an initiative or a court ruling that will lead to a different system that will be in place by this time next year. So if you don't like it, wait, it'll change. Going back to the weather jokes. So anyway, we have for the different races, get your pencil and paper ready. Starting with the U.S. Senate, and that's an easy one because you have on the Democratic side Patty Murray and two relatively unknown challengers who were kind of wing nuts. And on the Republican side, you have George Nethercutt. He of I can't count to three terms for term limits, and Reed Davis, who is an extremely conservative local professor at, I believe, Seattle Pacific University. And we're recommending that you skip both of those. Patty Murray's been no great shakes, even though she did vote for the war against Iraq. We'll give her props for that one. But for U.S. Representative, however, there is a very hotly contested race out on the east side. That's the only one. Jim McDermott and Jay Inslee and Adam Smith and Norm Dix are all running essentially unopposed. But on the east side, Jennifer Dunn's retiring in the District 8, and both the Democratic and Republican sides have contested races. On the Democratic side, you have Dave Ross, the Cairo talk show host, who, when it was announced that he was going to be running for office, I would have put about 60-40 that he was going to declare Democrat versus declaring Republican. He's very much center of the road. Not very predictable, which may be something that you want in a legislator. But when he's not predictable, it will be not predictable going toward the conservative wing. On the other hand, you have Heidi Hens, Barons-Benedict, Alex Albin, who both are more progressive. Barons-Benedict probably the more so, and so we went with her in that race. Then you have on the Republican side, you have Dave Rakert, who is probably the favorite. He's the King County Sheriff and has kind of made a career out of having very nice looking hair and sort of posturing as the tougher than tough cop, the Green River Killer and the tackling the WTO protesters in the street and this sort of thing. And we were actually recommending go with his opponent, Luke Esser, just to stop him, because Rakert is very much of an empty head when it comes to actually having policy ideas. He's basically a stuffed shirt is what it comes to. And he would be much tougher to defeat in the general election probably. So we were recommending a vote for his opponent, Luke Esser, on that one.
There was that interesting development relating to his campaign manager that just kind of culminated this morning's.
Yeah, his campaign manager.
Oh, I did not hear about this.
Yeah, his campaign manager resigned because I believe the man's name was Dave Borum.
There was the mess around his refusing to debate about a week ago.
Well, yeah, but this wasn't related to that. It was related to the fact that his campaign manager was also the director of this group that had been running the attack ads against Deborah Sen.
Oh,
in the state attorney general's race, yeah. And so his campaign manager decided to resign, saying that his involvement with this other group was shining negative light on Reichert's campaign.
Well, we'll talk about those ads a little bit more when we get to the attorney general's race.
Uh-huh.
But that's fascinating. I did not realize that he had resigned. I knew the connection, but. Okay, well, that's another reason not to vote for Dave Reichert. Let's see. Then we have also the statewide races, starting with governor, where you have Christine Gregoire facing off against Ron Sims. Neither of these two are all that great. Ron Sims has done a number of things in his role as King County executive that we've criticized on this show, from his budget cuts, but particularly in cutting social services. But at the same time, he has in this race done something that very few people running for statewide office have done, which is utter the words income tax and tax reform, talking about trying to come up with a saner tax structure for the state, and we'll give him credit for that. And then Gregoire, as state attorney general, has had problems with her as well. She, if you recall, put forward the essentially statewide version of a Patriot Act after 9/11, and we'll talk about that a little bit more when we get to the attorney general's race also. But that was struck down by Adam Klein in the state legislature, but it came very close to passing some fairly draconian laws that Gregoire, she's run a very Gary Lockean type of campaign where she really hasn't said very much, and she's just tried to look very pretty, and you know, the biggest controversy has been around her time in a sorority, but there's an edge to her also. So we're recommending Ron Sims in that. He's a little bit more liberal than she is.
Yeah, her campaign has been, you know, business as usual. Let's keep things going the same as they've been under Gary Locke. And I think there are enough people who are discontented with the situation here in the state that I think it makes sense to be looking elsewhere for change. Also, interestingly, Ron Sims has made the tax proposal the center of his campaign. In response, Christine Gregoire's response has been extremely lame. She's not come up with any other proposal to replace that. She's dodged the issue. She's given her support to some of the worst things that have happened under Gary Locke, including the enormous tax breaks for Boeing. Excuse me, for the Boeing Corporation, and she has said that we can review some of those tax credits to see if they've been effective. That's her only response when people have questioned her on that issue, and I find that to be extremely lame and something that she should not be elected for.
Yeah, I would agree with all of that. Lieutenant Governor, this is a race that, this is an office that should be abolished. It really has no purpose. Unfortunately, the Democratic incumbent is running unopposed, and there are none of the Republican candidates are calling for the abolition of the office, unlike the guy who ran 4 years ago. The person who comes closest, however, is it's a guy named Jim Nobles. His name was on the very crease of the paper I'm reading here. Guy named Jim Nobles who says he'll be a sort of a citizen ombudsman for this state, and we'll go with that among the three Republican opponents. And bearing in mind that you can choose either a Republican or a Democratic ballot, but not both. As you're going through these, Secretary of State, Secretary of Treasury, State Auditor are all unopposed. Attorney General, this is an interesting race on both the Republican and the Democratic side. On the Republican side, you have Rob McKenna, who is the King County Councilman from Bellevue. He's running in part his campaign in opposition to the Patriot Act and on sort of libertarian principles. Deserves support against his opponent for that reason, but also because if he gets off of King County Council. There's a 7-6 Republican Democratic split on King County Council right now. And his district in Bellevue is very much changing in terms of its demographics. So there's a fair chance that a Democrat might be elected in his place if he vacates that seat. So that's good reason for giving him a boost to the statewide level. On the Democratic side, McKenna's campaign is probably the folks who are behind these attack ads against Deborah Senn. Senn's office has been Senn's campaign rather has been saying it's the insurance industry. They represent her term as insurance commissioner, but it looks like all of the links that are coming out now to that office, and we've had the Elections Commission in the last couple of days saying that they have to reveal who they are, and they've been refusing, but probably sometime in the next 3 or 4 days we'll find out who's behind these attack ads. And when they are, it'll almost certainly have something to do with Rob McKenna's campaign. If that is the case, that would suggest also that McKenna is very concerned about how he's polling against Senn in the general, trying to defeat him in the primary, and by doing so, running against our old friend Mark Sidran. Now, Sidran is taking an interesting tack in this race. He's saying that for folks in Seattle who remember him as city attorney for 12 years, that the civility laws and all of the various draconian measures that he enacted as city attorney, those aren't relevant because he's coming in as a technician, as attorney general, that he doesn't want to politicize the office. He accuses Senn of having a political agenda. As attorney general, and she does. She very much has a political agenda, but it's an agenda to battle all the right battles for consumer protection and as opposed to Sidran, who you could very much imagine him launching a Patriot Act or some similar type of measure if we have some sort of a terrorist attack on his watch. So Senn on the Democratic side for Attorney General, and we'll find out who those attack ads belong to. That looks like it'll be very interesting. Mm-hmm. Let's move along here because we're running a little short on time. The Superintendent of Public Instruction, we had mild preference for Judith Billings over the incumbent Terry Burke. Bergeson,
although I think Juanita Doyon might also be
Juanita Doyon
a good
is
person to vote for. That's probably who I'll be voting for.
Yeah, she's good as well. She hasn't had nearly the support, but she's a good candidate.
Or definitely. The experience, but I think it's worth another protest vote.
She's a protest vote, particularly against Wassel. I think that's
she has a lot of good grassroots support, and she had a lot of support on the WEA as well.
Okay,
so.
Well, that's okay. Let's go
so
for
she's
her then.
Worthy of
let's go for
consideration.
Juanita Diane in that race then. The various state legislative districts. Bob Hasegawa is our choice over Ed Prince and a couple other folks to fill the seat being vacated by Velma Valoria. State District 30, that's in District 11. District 36, Alice Wolt despite her SEIU backing and all of the negative press that's gotten, Helen Summers has gotten a huge amount of big business backing also from outside the district in that race. An enormous amount of money is being spent on that one legislative race. And Alice Wolt has a long, long track record in peace and public justice issues. Social justice issues, rather, in the state and the city, and she's just a very good all-around person. So Alice Wolt in that race against Helen Summers, who, in her role in the state legislature, has been responsible for a lot of the social service cuts, very much enacting Gary Locke's budgetary assaults over the past few years.
And she would say that, oh, no, she's restored some of the programs that Locke wanted to cut. And that's true. However, I think she and many of the other Democratic leaders, particularly in the House, have not stood up enough to the Republican assault and taken the governor aside and said, "Look, whose side are you on?"
Yeah,
you know. And I think it's time to replace her with someone who's a bit more active on that score.
And this race is very much being seen as sort of a litmus test within the Democratic caucus in the state. It has statewide implications in terms of what the future of the Democratic caucus will be, and how much people will fight for those sort of social service programs. So I'm going to there are a handful of other state races that you can look up and eat the state. I'm going to skip those and go to the judges, because those are the races that people know the least about very often. The state Supreme Court, and we'll talk about the Supreme Court again a little bit in a couple minutes, but it is an important race. You have Barbara Madsen going for one position. She is an incumbent in the position number one. Mary Kay Becker is the best of a crowded field. Robert Alsdorf is also a good one in that race. One to avoid, Jim Johnson. He's Tim Eymann's personal attorney. He's running in that race as well. And then in position number six, Richard Sanders, the incumbent. He's quite conservative, but he's also an extremely good civil libertarian, probably one of the most valuable justices on the court right now for that reason. In some of the lower courts, we have the Court of Appeals, Division One, District Number One, Position One. C. Kenneth Gross is the choice. Superior Court, Position Number 13. Teresa Doyle has a good reputation in the various public defenders and lawyers that we called talking to about this. We had Position Number 23. Julia Garrett was the pick, and then position number 42, Catherine Moore was one. In position number 45, Kimberly Poacherman, and finally the Family and Education's Levy is up for renewal within the city of Seattle, and we vote yes on that one.
All right, and for those of you that couldn't keep up with your pens and pencils,
www.eatthestate.org. It's up there, or it's in the current issue.
On your newsstands now. All right, well...
free on your newsstands
that's
now.
That's right.
Or you can send us email if it's not up on the website. Sometimes we're a little late posting. You can send us email to ets@scn or to tomchick@drizzle.com, and we'll forward you a copy.
Yep.
All right. So, Thurston County and the Supreme Court.
Yeah, well, Thurston County Superior Court ruled this week that the state's Defense of Marriage Act, which is the act that was passed several years ago that defines marriage as being between a man and a woman, trying to preempt the eventuality of gay marriage becoming legal, that act is unconstitutional. This comes in addition to a King County Superior Court ruling along the same lines about 3 weeks ago. Those two between them mean that sometime in the next year or so, we're going to have a ruling in the state Supreme Court. This is something to keep in mind when you're voting for Sanders and some of those other state Supreme Court justices on the legality of gay marriage. So Washington State, something to look forward to. We will probably be one of the first states, outside Massachusetts and Hawaii, which have already been through this, to be a battleground in terms of the legality of gay marriage. That's something that was not made especially clear in the news coverage of it earlier this week. That's where this is heading.
All right. Well, that takes us then to This Week in Iraq.
Yes, the top headline this week in Iraq was the U.S. casualty count. 20 U.S. troops died this week, most of them in roadside bombings, including 7 Marines who died in one attack near the city of Fallujah on Monday. That brings the total U.S. deaths in Iraq to 1,007 as of yesterday. Now, that doesn't count 65 troops from Britain who have died, 66 other coalition troops who have died as well, and that makes the total 1,138. That's an average of 2 per day. However, so far for the month of September, with 29 dead in 10 days, that's nearly 3 men a day. Now, as usual, when U.S. troop losses go up that much, the U.S. military tends to respond with revenge attacks, and they have done that in spades this week. Fallujah has been bombed for 4 nights in a row, possibly 5 nights. I didn't check the news this morning. Tal Afar, a city of about 220,000 people, which lies west of Mosul near the northern border with Turkey and Syria, was attacked with massive force, bombings, artillery, etc. And that really was a desperation move by the U.S. military to try to cut off guerrilla units that they think are coming across the border from Syria through Tal Afar and into Mosul. As I've said here in the last few weeks on the air, that the guerrillas are making a big push to gain control of the third largest city in Iraq. That's Mosul. Now, it's not entirely clear that the guerrillas fighting in Mosul are coming across the border from Syria, and so this attack on Tal Afar may actually be just another way that the U.S. military will create more guerrilla troops by alienating more of the civilian population.
It's just really counterproductive in a lot of ways.
In addition, there was very heavy fighting in the Sadr City neighborhood of Baghdad. Once again, the capital city, the largest neighborhood of 2.5 million Shiites, remains outside of U.S. military control and the control of the Iraqi police and National Guard. Now, the U.S. military in all of these situations is claiming massive guerrilla casualties. However, reporters on site have gotten into the habit of going to the local hospitals to check and see exactly who is coming into the hospital morgue and who is being treated for wounds. Now, so we had the terrible situation this week of print reporters as well as television reporters, not for Al Jazeera TV, mind you, but for Reuters TV and the BBC and other what most folks would consider more respectable, or I guess you would say more Western mainstream outlets, because Al Jazeera is a respectable outlet. But you had those TV places showing photos of children being bandaged in these hospitals, of women's dead bodies, of a baby found in the rubble of a house, etc. And I just want to take a quote out of a New York Times article. At the very end of this article, the article was entitled, let's see here, U.S. military kills scores in fighting near Mosul, and that was printed yesterday. Near the end of the article, they finally talk about who actually was killed in places like Tal Afar and Fallujah, and they talk about the bombing of Fallujah after interviewing U.S. military sources saying, well, we just killed 3 associates of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the Jordanian terrorist that the U.S. wants to blame for all of the attacks in Iraq to the point of absolute ridiculousness. And then the U.S. military spokesman said, well, no one else was killed. Then the article says, quote, as the day progressed, news accounts and photographs of dead women and children, along with credible witness reports, told a different story. At least 8 people died. This is in just one bombing attack in Fallujah, including 4 children and 2 women, a local doctor told the Associated Press. And another 16 people, including 8 children, were wounded. In the rubble of a demolished house, workers found only one survivor, a 10-month-old infant, said Ahmed Jabir, a member of the rescue team. Now, U.S. military spokesmen and the Bush administration always have a single excuse for that kind of atrocity. And their excuse goes something like this. They say, the terrorists shouldn't be hiding among civilians, and they're using them as human shields. However, I think we have to point out 2 very important points here. One is that the U.S. is the aggressor when it drops bombs in the middle of the night on heavily populated neighborhoods of a city like Fallujah, and particularly when they rely on unreliable intelligence. Now, Fallujah is in the same position that the whole of Iraq was in before the U.S. invasion. It's a no-go area for U.S. troops and intelligence personnel, and the U.S. knows very, very, very little about what's going on inside Fallujah. Now, considering that we invaded the country thinking that there were weapons of mass destruction there and we were so totally wrong, you might get an idea that perhaps bombing a building in Fallujah with the notion that there might be 3 of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi's men there and finding that there were women and children there instead, well, you think somebody would learn from that, and they obviously haven't. The other thing that needs to be pointed out is, as the occupying power, the U.S. is constrained by international law from carrying out acts of revenge or targeting the civilian population. we can just add this, I guess, to another of the long, long, long list of U.S. crimes in this country.
Can I add one more thing that that report points out? That U.S. military spokespeople and spokespeople for the Bush administration have been routinely lying about what they already know about deaths in Iraq, about what kind of casualties their attacks inflict.
Yeah, and they've been caught several times.
They've been caught repeatedly. This has been something that has occurred over and over and over again in the last year and a half.
Yeah, it's become routine for me to see press reports of that show in the first several paragraphs. This is what the Pentagon says were the number of people killed in this attack, and they were all guerrillas, and it was like 300 people, etc. And then later in the article, reading the reporter saying, I went to the hospital, this is the numbers that I saw, there were 30 people. So the figure's inflated by a factor of 10, and the majority of the casualties were civilians. That's happened over and over and over again, and this week is no exception. In fact, it's an escalation of the same policy. Now, speaking of international crimes, I just want to cover another one. We can add yet another one to that list. Army officers this week told the Senate Armed Services Committee that the CIA and U.S. Army jailers at detention facilities, not just Abu Ghraib in Iraq, but in other detention facilities in Iraq, hid dozens of Iraqi prisoners from the Red Cross. So they had them detained but did not give their names to the Red Cross as required by international law. And it was not just the 7 or 8 that the U.S. Army had owned up to previously. The figure may be as high as 100 men.
This is the sort of thing, by the way, that if Saddam Hussein had been doing it in his regime, we'd be up in arms about.
That's right. It really, the fact that it's 100 men, that it's as high as 100 men, really proves that the U.S. military had a policy of disappearing people in Iraq.
Yeah.
How is that different from the way someone like Saddam Hussein would disappear people in Iraq when he was in control? Really, you have to ask that question. And I think what really struck me was that these Army officers said that one prisoner that they know of, maybe more, one prisoner was transferred to a ship held on an army ship, and that is on a Navy ship, and that was in direct violation of the Geneva Conventions, which states outright that you do not hold prisoners on a ship. You must put them on land as soon as possible, and you must register with them with the Red Cross.
Yeah, that hearing during that hearing, the report that was based on is, I can't remember the name of the report, but it's like a 9,000-page report, and there's only 176 pages that have been released so far.
Yeah.
So Senator Mark Dayton had brought that up. It's like,
so this is the minimum that we know. This
yeah,
is
what's
the
going on
yeah,
with those other, you know, 8,000
quite a bit more to come.
Pages, right?
Yeah, so you can think about that. You know, here's 8,000 and X number of pages, and there's got to be something on there. You know, I mean, they don't just generate 8,000 pages of nothing.
More good reasons to not reelect George Bush.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, with that, we are pretty much out of time. Talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. And tell people where they can find Eat the State.
Eat the State can be found in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, other places where you find free newspapers. We can also be found on the web at www.eatthestate.org. If you have questions, comments, and tips, you can give us a call at 206-903-9461, or you can email us at ets@scn.org, or you can email me at tomchick@drizzle.com.
And you're always looking for volunteers as well.
Yes, we are.
Oh, yeah.
What's
donations.
What's your volunteer of the week?
we could use someone who enjoys putting on fundraising benefits for us.
Yeah,
we have
be great.
We have musicians and bands that would like to play and do benefits for us, but we don't have a lot of volunteer energy to really sit down and call clubs and try to organize benefits. So if you like to throw parties and you like to do that
kind of thing, we could
use someone who does that.
Talking about doing something for our anniversary, which is yesterday, actually. It was our 8th anniversary as Eat the State. And
yes, one day before the anniversary of the overthrow of Salvador Allende in Chile.
Which is why we all remember September 11th.
That's right.
All right.